Hello. You have discovered the Felon File. FelonFile.com is a podcast exploration and discussion of law enforcement, history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains and elsewhere. Felon File is hosted by Scott Lunsford, retired police detective, sergeant, author and researcher. The Shade of Blue Stories for Felon File Today. Episode 6. 20. 1984. Did a father poison his children? Did he murder his 5-year-old daughter? What did the family think? What did the lawyers think? What did the jury think? What would you decide? Background music track Unspoken by Mew. The sponsor for today's episode of The Felon File is The Happy Hill Restaurant. Located on Patton Avenue in West Asheville, North Carolina. Let Mr. Mike fix you breakfast, lunch, or dinner. You won't be disappointed. Scott, we're recording.
Welcome back to A Felon File, a podcast where we look at crime and punishment, the good guys, the bad guys, law enforcement, court cases, the court itself, anything that might be of interest along those lines that happens in the Appalachian Mountains and elsewhere. And as Victoria said, and thank you, Victoria, for running the show again, I am your host, Scott Lunsford, and we're coming to you from the Scratch Ankle International Podcasting Studio in Scratch Ankle, North Carolina. That's west of Asheville, east of Canton, and make a left at Inca. 1984. Everybody's familiar with that. A lot of people are also familiar with the novel, the fiction novel by George Orwell, published in 1949. That was titled 1984. Orwell's final book that he completed in his lifetime, the novel about mass surveillance and repression of rights, the regimentation of persons and behavior, the facts and politics and the way they are manipulated. I kind of think he missed the title just a little bit by about 37 to 40 years. Well, let's talk about the real 1984. 1984, President Ronald Reagan announced that the United States will begin development of a permanently crewed space station and invite international space agencies to help. Originally referred to as the Space Station Freedom, this later evolved into the International Space Station, which is still circling today. 1984, Apple releases the Macintosh personal computer. See George Orwell reference above. 1984, another incident that happened, Gary Plache fatally shot Jeff Dorsett at the Baton Rouge Metropolitan Airport in Louisiana. Now, Leon Gary Plache killed Jeff Dorsett, who was his son's karate instructor. He was also his son's kidnapper, sexually assaulter, and molester of Plache's son, Jody. The killing was caught on tape by a news crew who were waiting at the airport for Dorsett to arrive from California, where he had been arrested. There's really no questions that Plache shot and killed Dorsett. He did it live with video coverage, which, again, 1984, that was kind of lucky for the news crew. He admitted to doing it. He couldn't argue too much since the killing was on tape. He was given a 7-year suspended sentence with 5 years probation and 300 hours of community service for the shooting and killing his son's abuser. But he did not receive any prison time. The case received wide publicity because some people questioned whether Plache should have been charged with murder or just turned loose. Years later, he ended up dying from a stroke, but before he died, he said that he was in the right and that those in a similar position would have done the same thing. I just hope I'm never in such a position. Another interesting incident that happened, 1984. The teachers at the McMartin Preschool in Manhattan Beach, California, were charged with satanic ritual abuse of the school's children. The case ended up lasting for 7 years, but resulted in no convictions, and all charges were dropped in 1990. By the time it was all over, it had become the longest and most expensive trial in American history at that time. The charges were unfounded, and many of the children were improperly interviewed, and a lot of evidence collected was based on recessed memories and other issues. When one of the adult main witnesses testifies that one of the perpetrators can fly around the room by magic, kind of hurts the credibility of that witness, and the trial kind of goes south at that point. The same time as the McMartin Preschool investigation started, Richard Johnson and his wife Brenda Johnson in Western North Carolina were having marriage issues, and they separated in March of 1984. Unusually, Dad kept custody of the two children, 11-year-old son Christopher and his 5-year-old daughter Joyce. And it's easy to say, without question, the separation was less than amicable. At one point, Mr. Johnson and Mrs. Johnson had a big row over the mom's access and visitation rights to the children. Now, during the argument that was witnessed by other family members, Dad asked Mom if she remembered Jim Ward and what he had done to his family. Now, this reference was to an incident about 7 years previous. 34-year-old James Ward of Fairview, North Carolina, killed his two children, Donna Jean, 7, and James Doyle, 12. He then took his own life with the same gun he used to murder his children. It's a murder-suicide. That was in June of 1977. And it was estimated that this was an implied threat by Mr. Johnson, that if he couldn't have the children, nobody was going to have the children. Later in court, Ms. Johnson stated that Richard threatened to do the same thing that James Ward did in 1977 to his kids. In June of 1984, Richard Johnson was living in Hot Springs, North Carolina, with his 11-year-old son, Christopher, and 5-year-old daughter, Joyce. Richard's father was the small town of Hot Springs police chief. In early June of 1984, the 11-year-old son, Christopher, ended up being transported to Memorial Mission Hospital. At the time, Christopher was sweating profusely. His pupils were pinpointed. His chest muscles were fluctuating violently, almost like a stroke, and his speech was slurred. He was diagnosed as suffering from organ phosphate poisoning. An antidote was administered, and Christopher soon began to recover. He was released the following day. Dad claimed to have been using a bug poison, organ phosphate, or a version of it, to treat the house that they were living in at the time. Christopher must have been exposed because of that. 4 days later, 5-year-old Joyce Johnson was brought to the same hospital, suffering from nausea, abdominal pain, headaches, and pain during urination. She was diagnosed at first with a urinary tract infection, and the doctor prescribed an antibiotic, which was described in court later as a sweet-smelling dark orange liquid. If you're a parent, you're familiar with that from having to give that particular antibiotic to your toddler at some point. She was sent home with her father after the treatment when she had stabilized. Now later, on the morning of June 17, 1984, Dad told the 11-year-old brother Christopher to look after his sister while the father went to town and conducted some business. Now, before Dad left, he gave Joyce a teaspoon of white liquid. The brother would later say that the liquid had an odor similar to bug spray or bug poisoning. After the dad left, not long after that, Joyce became sick again. White foam was coming from her mouth. Her stomach was growling. She was staggering. Her speech was impaired. She was talking nonsense. And this scared little Christopher. Christopher stated that Joyce eventually laid down on the bed and just stopped moving entirely. Not knowing what else to do, the brother just waited for his dad to come back. Now, while this was all going on at the house, Johnson had gone to the cafe in Hot Springs and ordered and ate breakfast. As Dad was leaving, he approached one of the local emergency medical technicians, or EMTs, who also was in the cafe eating breakfast. Johnson asked him about the location of the town ambulance at the time. He apparently had not seen it where it was usually parked in town when he came in. The EMT said the ambulance was in the garage next to where it was usually kept so it could be painted and worked on. The emergency medical technician asked why he wanted to know. Was he in need of an ambulance? Now, the father responded, "Well, I might need it later." And then he just turned and left. It was a strange conversation that the EMT would recall later in much detail because it was so strange. Employees at the cafe also ended up testifying in court about the conversation that they had overheard between Johnson and the EMT. They had overheard it as well. Now, getting home once more, Dad found out his daughter was sick again. Immediately taking her to the ambulance station in Hot Springs, the ambulance was brought out. The EMTs placed Joyce in the back and proceeded on to Asheville, North Carolina, where the hospital would be. Dad and brother followed in a pickup truck. Near the Madison County and Buncombe County line, the hospital was actually in Buncombe County, Joyce was transferred to a Buncombe County ambulance, which took her on to Asheville Memorial Mission Hospital. They arrived just before 10 a.m. A Dr. Thomas Howard treated the little girl, who was not breathing and had no pulse at the time. She was still foaming at the mouth, and her pupils were very pinpointed. The doctor told investigators later that the secretions of foam from her mouth had an odor which he associated with organ phosphate insecticides such as diazinon or malthurin. He found the same odor where the little girl had thrown up on her clothing as well. Also, the doctor told investigators that organ phosphate poisoning is the only type of poison that would cause the symptoms which he observed. And his opinion was that the poison was given orally as opposed to being absorbed through the skin as you would get through casual exposure. The doctor also was of the opinion that in order for Joyce to exhibit the symptoms that he observed, she would have had to orally ingest the poison within 30 minutes to 2 hours of the onset of the symptoms. He also stated that the symptoms he observed could not have been the result of general exposure to organ phosphate poisoning, like what you would expect if it had been used to treat a house that somebody lived in. Add to this a mixture of chaos, so to speak, because according to hospital staff, Johnson and his estranged wife, Brenda, who had arrived at the hospital, had loud arguments there in the hospital when they would both be there at the same time or the same point in the hospital to visit Joyce. There was such a constant infighting between the two when they were both there that the staff finally told them that they couldn't be there at the same time. They had to visit at different times. Doctors tried to reverse the effects of the poison, but Joyce suffered irreparable brain death. She was taken off life support on the afternoon of January 20th, 1984, and Joyce died approximately 30 minutes later without ever regaining consciousness again. An autopsy was performed and showed that, in the medical examiner's opinion, Joyce's death was caused by extensive swelling of and the softening of the brain. Further, it was this opinion would be consistent with a finding of death resulting from organ phosphate poisoning. A friend of the defendant, Johnson, later told investigators that he had a conversation with the dad at the hospital and that dad had told him that the doctors had said Joyce had gotten in some kind of poison. The friend stated that Johnson offered to take him to the house and show him what Joyce had gotten into. He also testified later in court the defendant said half a teaspoon of the poison would kill a person. Kind of an odd thing to bring up in conversation. The friend would later testify that approximately 1 month after Johnson and his wife Barbara had separated, the defendant told him that he would rather see his kids in hell as with his wife having custody of them. Well, after the investigation, or the preliminary investigation, a grand jury was convened in Madison County where the incident had started. John Neal, a supervising chemist with the Occupational Health Pesticide Unit of the Public Health Laboratory of North Carolina, testified for the state. He analyzed a stomach fluid sample which had been taken from Joyce Johnson upon her arrival at the hospital there in Asheville. Mr. Neal testified that the sample contained 18.9 micrograms of diazepam per gram of liquid. A true bill was issued and a trial date in Marshall, the Madison County County seat, was set up. Now, when the trial came up in Madison County, Christopher Lewis Johnson, now 12-year-old, testified, said his father had poured a teaspoon full of liquid, he saw this happen, from a white medicine bottle for his sister, and then he left, leaving the two children alone in the house. Christopher testified that his sister Joyce became sick within minutes of swallowing the liquid, and that the white foam started coming out of her mouth soon after that. After an extensive trial and a hung jury, the trial was later moved to neighboring Buncombe County. And again, Christopher told what had occurred, tearfully explaining to the Buncombe County jury of 7 women and 5 men that his sister quit moving and remained motionless on the bed some 8 or 10 minutes after their father had left the house. And he said the white bottle of liquid smelled something like bug spray. In the Buncombe County trial, Dr. Paige Hudson, chief medical examiner for the state of North Carolina, testified. He told the court that organ phosphate poisoning may be introduced in the body through oral ingestion or absorption through the skin. He stated, however, that his experience and training indicated that oral phosphate or this bug spray poisoning could cause serious illness or death only when it has been taken internally, orally ingested. Dr. Hudson believed a teaspoon of diazepam administered orally would be fatal to a child of Joyce's age and size. The doctor also testified that various symptoms exhibited by Joyce, noted by her brother, Christopher, and the EMTs and the medical personnel at the hospital were consistent with organ phosphate poisoning. He also agreed with the other doctor's opinion that Joyce's death was caused by brain damage resulting from the poisoning. Over the objection of counsel, Johnson testified on his own behalf. Later, he filed a motion to represent himself in court and tried his best to do so in the original trial that occurred in Madison County. The attorneys that were assigned to help him when he represented himself in court in Madison County also worked with him when the case was moved to Buncombe County and retried. Now, his excuse for the whole situation was that in early June of 1984, he had sprayed his house with Maltheron in order to alleviate an insect problem. The insecticide which was left over was placed in a container and left on the back porch. The father went on to say in court that on the morning of 17th of June, 1984, he woke up his two children and prepared to go into town to get some gas. When Joyce acted as though she was not feeling well, he remembered that they had been to the hospital earlier and she was on some medication. The defendant stated he went to the refrigerator, got the bottle of medicine, and gave Joyce one teaspoon, as he was supposed to. He then proceeded into town. He admitted asking the EMT in the cafe about the whereabouts of the ambulance, but he indicated that he did so merely out of curiosity after observing or seeing that it was not where it was usually located. Johnson also denied telling his friend that he had poison at his house at all. On the stand, he denied making the statement attributed to him by his wife when he threatened to kill his children, comparing it to the tragic incident that had happened in 1977. Johnson continued to express that he loved his children and denied giving poison to either one of them. Leroy Johnson, the defendant's father, and by this time the former chief of police for the town of Hot Springs, testified that he took Christopher that first time to the hospital when he became sick in early June. Grandfather Johnson told the doctor that Christopher had entered the house immediately after being sprayed for insects. The doctor asked if there were any of the insecticide remaining, and Mr. Johnson said yes, and that he had brought it with him to the hospital. He testified that he never saw the poison again. Now, the grandmother also testified that after Christopher was poisoned, the defendant scrubbed the entire house in an effort to remove all traces of that poison. Carol Johnson, Johnson's sister-in-law, testified that she was present during one of the fights between the couple where Dad was alleged to have threatened to kill his children. Now, she also stated that she did not recall the defendant making any type of a statement with regard to a ward man from Hot Springs, which he actually wasn't from Hot Springs. He was from Fairview, North Carolina. The defense also produced several witnesses who testified about the defendant's good relationship with his children. But the jury found Johnson guilty of first-degree murder. Now, of course, without question, the defense filed an appeal saying the court had messed up in not appointing a medical expert to the defense's team, that the state had access to their choice of experts, but the defense did not. Such an expert would have aided in the investigation and preparation of his trial through the evaluation of medical reports, the autopsy results, and any samples that were given, and the prevailing scientific data on organ phosphate poisonings. Now, defense stated that the denial of the motion deprived him of his right to a fair trial. Well, the North Carolina Court of Appeals didn't buy it, and this was backed up by a similar ruling that was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court earlier. Furthermore, in his brief before the court, Johnson said that his mother had received a letter from Dr. Edgar Flint, director of the Industrial Medicine Corporation, who made diazoxide, the poison that was used. The letter discloses that Dr. Flint had been provided with and had reviewed the medical records in question. In the letter, Dr. Flint provided a great deal of expert information and offered to answer any further questions that the defense counsel might have. The Court of Appeals pointed out that an expert had made himself available to the defense, but they had failed to make use of him. The next argument that Johnson had for the courts was that the defendant argued that the practice of what they referred to as death qualifying, that's where the jury is polled their personal opinions on the death penalty, and if they feel very strongly against the death penalty and feel that would keep them from making a fair judgment in the trial, they would be excused. Now, the attorneys for Johnson said that this violated the federal Constitution on the grounds that it resulted in the selection of a jury already biased in favor of the prosecution and the death penalty on the issue of guilt, which is not composed of a cross-section of the community. Johnson felt that everybody there was armed and ready to go. It was pointed out, though, that the U.S. Supreme Court had held that the federal Constitution does not prohibit the removal for cause prior to the guilt-innocent determination phase of a capital or death penalty case or prospective jurors whose opposition to the death penalty is so strong that it would impair the performance of their duties as jurors at the sentencing phase of the trial. Johnson's objection to that was thrown out. He then argued about the instruction given to the jury by the court. The trial instructed the jury in a pertinent part, describing to the jury, the judge did, what they needed to have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt three things. First, that the defendant intentionally caused poison to be placed into or on the body or in the body of Joyce Johnson. Second, the state must prove that the defendant had done this with malice. Malice means not only hatred, ill will, or spite. And third, the state must prove that the poisoning was a proximate cause of the death. Now, the defense team argued the jury was not instructed in order to return a conviction for first-degree murder. It was required to find that he possessed the specific intent to kill Joyce at the time of the poisoning. This didn't work either, because the appeals court said, well, you're saying that you didn't administer it, the poison, but if you try to plead this, you're saying that you did administer the poisoning, but you didn't mean to harm her or cause her death. Well, that was thrown out too. The court appeal stated the defendant received a fair trial, free from prejudicial error on the part of the court system and the public. And because of that, Richard L. Johnson, the offender, son of the police chief, North Carolina Department of Corrections offender number 212278, is currently serving a life in prison with no chance of parole. He did not get the death penalty, but he was permanently removed from society. He also, while locked up, has racked up in the North Carolina Department of Corrections facility over 151 separate infractions for various offenses that he committed while in jail or in prison. Use of profane language, drug violations, lock tampering, unauthorized leave, disobeying orders, assaulting staff with weapons, regular assaulting of the staff. That's just to name a few of the 150 some odd things that he has done in the controlled environment of the North Carolina Department of Corrections. Mr. Johnson will be incarcerated for the rest of his life. Then no doubt he will then take residence in that special level of hell reserved for child abusers, children murderers, and people who call on the phone trying to sell you an extended warranty on your car. And that's our Felon File Shade of Blue story for this Saturday. Thank you for listening. If you have thoughts on this podcast and would like to share them, you can contact us through the felonfile.com webpage or scottlunsfordauthor.com. You can email us directly as well, Victoria and I, at felonfile@gmail.com. And if you would be interested in copies of my books, fiction and nonfiction works, you can find them at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And links to the websites are on my website. Don't forget to check out our stuff page also on the website. You can pick up a Felon File t-shirt or a coffee mug. Almost nothing communicates to your work peers to leave you alone in the morning better than having your coffee in a Felon File mug while wearing a Felon File t-shirt. You can also support the Felon File podcast by buying Victoria or me a cup of coffee from the link at the bottom of one of the web pages. That goes to help pay for copies of court records and other information and Freedom of Information applications. If you have a good idea for a Shade of Blues podcast story you would like us to research to put out there, drop us a line. If you think others might find it of interest, just let us know. Send us a message. In the meantime, in the coming weeks, remember, be safe and be secure. Don't let the Shade of Blue stories frighten you from doing good things for other people. It's still the right thing to do for ourselves and our community. And we'll talk to you next Saturday here on Felon File at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, USA. Bye, y'all.
You have been listening to the Felon File podcast with your host, Scott Lunsford. For more information on this podcast or Scott's books and writings, go to scottlunsfordauthor.com and felonfile.com. Scott can also be contacted at these websites. Be sure to check out the stuff page on the website. Pick up a Felon File t-shirt or coffee mug. You can also support the Felon File podcast by buying us a coffee from the link on the website. This is Victoria, your producer. Thank you for listening. 2-1. End. Background track unspoken by MewSoundCloud.com. Mew music promoted by free. StockMusic.com Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 Unported License. CreativeCommons.org